Welcome to Foresight Friday Roundup, Foresight Health's podcast series for healthcare revolutionaries. Outcomes matter, customers count, and value rules. Hello again, everyone. This is Dave Burdett, news editor at Foresight Health. It is Friday, February 11th. Valentine's Day is February 14th. That means you have another 2 days before you have to run out at the last minute to find a card, flowers, and candy. Good luck. On today's episode of the Roundup, we're going to talk about structural racism in the healthcare system and about health equity. Specifically, we'll be talking about a new study in health affairs on structural racism in historic and modern health policy, and a recent viewpoint in JAMA that calls for expanding the quadruple aim into the quintuple aim by adding health equity to the industry's overarching goals. To give us their take on these important developments are Dave Johnson, founder and CEO of Foresight Health, and Julie Murchison, partner at Transformation Capital. Hi, Dave. Hi, Julie. How are you guys doing this morning? Dave?
On the Valentine's Day front, it's very hard to surprise my wife, particularly since we're living together 24/7 during COVID. So I snuck out yesterday while Terry was on a Zoom session and had the local florist create an arrangement of red and white roses that I surprised her with yesterday afternoon. So mission accomplished there. Otherwise, this has been a terrific week. It isn't Rolling Stone, but I got my picture on the cover of this month's HFM magazine, where I'm now a featured columnist. Also, Health Affairs published a two-part article by Zeke Emanuel, Meryl Guzner, Matt Guido, and me on potentially expanding Maryland's unique payment model to other states. And finally, just retired superstar CEO of Jefferson, Steve Klasko, published his debut commentary yesterday on the Foresight Health website platform. Welcome, Steve. It's been a big week.
Yeah, maybe we should get you flowers.
There you go.
Julia. Do you have a list that long for this past week?
Yeah, I'm feeling a little underaccomplished, I have to say. But I will say the highlight of my week was meeting with somebody from Primera locally, like we used to in the old days when you'd have a cocktail after work and talk shop. And it was just so delightful.
Well, sign us some normalcy. That's great. Good for you. Before we talk about structural racism in healthcare and health equity, I wanted to talk about your experiences in those areas. Dave, have you ever witnessed or experienced either one in your interactions with the healthcare system?
Last year, Dave, I interviewed the CEO of a Chicago safety net hospital that was inundated far beyond its capacity with COVID patients. The hospital serves a primarily Latino population on the West Side. And the CEO lamented about his inability to transfer their sickest and most complex patients to the region's tertiary and quaternary centers. These advanced care hospitals, almost all nonprofit, refused to accept the transfers. That was that. People died unnecessarily, even though the safety net hospital and its caregivers were absolutely heroic under crisis conditions. That inability to receive complex COVID care wouldn't have happened to me or any of my family members. That's structural racism at work.
Wow, quite a story. Thanks, Dave. Julie, how about you? Have you witnessed or experienced racism or health inequity in your dealings with the healthcare system?
Well, I've been to the emergency room with my mother a few more times than I would like. And what I am not sure what I've witnessed is whether it's been racism or just dealing with social issues that often affect certain races and socioeconomic classes. But I've seen plenty of examples of challenging people in the ER having to, you know, be treated poorly and be, you know, quote unquote, controlled by the nurses and caregivers around them in ways that just aren't pleasant for anyone else there. And I think what is so sad is that there's just a lot of issues that create a callousness or a lack of kind of kindness in those situations. So I think I've experienced it, but I couldn't put my hand on the fact that, yes, that's structural racism. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes total sense. And I think that's a good segue into my story. I took my mom to an urgent care center last year. And while we were at the center turned away a Black woman who had fallen at work and hit her head on the floor. She had a lump on her head and a bad headache. You know, you could hear the whole conversation as we were sitting there. And the center told her they were at capacity and to go to the ER or come back later. and she left without being seen by a doctor or nurse. Yeah. You know, I thought it was very strange, and to borrow your word, Julie, very callous. So I'm not sure that would have happened to my mom if she had the same situation.
Yeah,
it just stuck with me, and I think it'll stick with me for quite a while. Okay, let's talk about this new report in Health Affairs. The report says structural racism shapes the healthcare system in ways that advantage the white population, the racial group in power, and disadvantage racial and ethnic minority populations. The report said payers, which include employers, health insurance companies, states, and the federal government, have created a two-tier financing system that limits equitable access to high-quality care for racial and ethnic minority populations. Dave, what's your reaction to the report? Surprising, not surprising? And how can we use health policy today to fix the problems identified in the report?
Not surprising at all. Unfortunately, structural racism is endemic to U.S. healthcare. It is an obvious and inconvenient truth. Let me illustrate with a story from my own background. In the mid-90s, I was the lead investment banker on a large bond issue for West Suburban Hospital, which sits on the border of Oak Park, a largely white community, and the Austin neighborhood of Chicago, a largely black community. During the rating agency presentation, the CEO put up a slide with the hospital's clinic locations. It had several dozen in Oak Park and River Forest. There was just one in Austin. Despite the access difference, the CEO waxed on at length about West Suburban's outreach and commitment to the Austin neighborhood. At the time, I remember sitting there and wondering how Jesse Jackson would have responded to this obvious maldistribution of physician clinics by this nonprofit hospital. That rating agency presentation was 25 years ago, but I'm certain that access to healthcare services in the Austin community hasn't improved. And like so many other healthcare institutions, West Suburban Hospital, which is still operating, is one face of the systematic racism plaguing America's ethnic minorities. The Health Affairs report you referenced, Dave, on structural racism in historical and modern U.S. health policy is well-researched, well-documented, insightful, impossible to argue with, and absolutely damning. The report identifies three primary factors that combine to create profound structural racism in the delivery of healthcare services. Health insurance coverage is the first. Minorities are much less likely to have health insurance, and those that do are much more likely to have policies with high deductibles and lower quality service providers. Financing, that's the second factor. Differential pricing is a unique and deviant feature of U.S. healthcare. Institutions treating low-income minorities receive, on average, much lower payments for equivalent care services. And then finally, access to high-quality care. Compared with white patients, racial and ethnic minority patients are less likely to receive evidence-based cardiovascular care, kidney transplants, diagnostic screenings for breast and colon cancer, timely cancer and stroke treatment, appropriate mental health services, and on and on and on. The result of all this is a two-tiered healthcare system that systematically discriminates against people of color. Can there be any surprise that life expectancy between adjacent white communities like Oak Park that I mentioned earlier and minority communities like Austin often exceeds 20 years? On the policy front, addressing structural racism requires fundamental, not incremental change. Most importantly, we have to get the money and incentives right. For example, dual eligible populations, individuals qualifying for both Medicare and Medicaid, so old, poor, and often sick people, have great care options because the combined payment is robust. Dual eligible funding is a significant component underlying Oak Street Health's success. Getting the money right means equalizing treatment payments to providers for commercial Medicare and Medicaid patients. This is what the state of Maryland does and what Zeke and I and the others wrote about this week in Health Affairs. We also need to make it easier for individuals to flip between subsidized exchange policies and Medicaid. Too many people fall through the cracks today. We need better oversight to ensure minorities receive the care the law entitles them to. Quite honestly, if I were healthcare czar, I'd combine all government-funded healthcare programs into one large entity, making it so big that the marketplace would have to provide adequate access to everyone with that insurance coverage. And then finally, health is so much more than healthcare. As a nation, we need to invest in healthy multipliers, including housing, transportation, education, to promote greater individual and community well-being, particularly for minorities. There's just so much to do.
Got it, Dave. Thanks. Julie, any comments or questions for Dave?
Yeah, I'm so struck by how we created the safety net in a way that actually created a lot more inequity based on benefits and, you know, level of care. It's so striking, Dave. I'm wondering if you found anything about, you know, what people have talked about for a long time around the healthcare workforce. And when you think about what some of the data is that Bridget Duffy and the Experience Innovation Network was putting out, maybe, gosh, a year ago by now, about how there's inequity in how the workforce is treated, and that creates safety issues that then create safety issues for patients. So here's my question. The workforce, if you read some of the reports, women and Black women in particular are in some of the most low-paying jobs, and, you know, minorities are pervasive in low-paying jobs in healthcare. And they talk about how it comes from slavery and, you know, kind of the service culture of what America's grown up on. How do we fix that?
Wow, that's a big question. I would say the U.S. is unique in world history in that we are going to be the first nation in the not too distant future with a majority minority population. So sometime in the next 25 years, the U.S. will have more non-white people than white people. And if we don't figure this out, and it's not easy, then life in America is going to continue to spiral downward. So addressing these questions of structural racism are important, not only in healthcare, but broadly across society. But particularly as it relates to the healthcare workforce and the disproportionate numbers of Black women in particular that are in service occupations like health workers and so on, I actually think there's an opportunity here. Paul Kusserow, Julie, a great friend of yours and mine, when he took over at Amedisys, took the first 3 months, packed a suitcase, and interviewed workers, asking them what they needed to do their jobs better. And he took copious notes, and that became the strategic plan for Amedisys, which went from $11 a share to over $300 a share under Paul's leadership. And the simple theory was, you know, treat your workers well, they'll treat your customers well, and the business will benefit as a result of that. And he's proven that point. So this reality is there. We've got disproportionate numbers of Black women, low-income women working in these health service jobs. But if we flip our framework around like Paul did and see these individuals as a real asset and invest in them, I think they can transform companies like they did Amedisys, and by transforming companies one by one, transform the healthcare system.
Yeah, great thinking.
No, that is interesting. Thanks, Dave. Now let's talk about this recent viewpoint in JAMA. You know the triple aim: improving population health, enhancing the care experience, and reducing costs. You know the quadruple aim, those three plus improving the work life of providers. Now, three physicians from George Washington University, Johns Hopkins, and Weill Cornell Medical College are calling for another aim, advancing health equity. They said achieving the other aims without health equity would be a hollow victory. Julie, what are your thoughts on adding health equity as a fifth aim? Why is it important? And do you think it'll make a difference?
The Pollyanna in me struggles a bit with the fact that we have to call health equity out as its own aim because, you know, it should be inherent that we treat everyone equally. But after all, it's what we're talking about. It's not how society works. I then look at health equity being added as an aim as really being all about systems thinking. Since we've all been around long enough to remember the IOM's 2001 Crossing the Chasm report, you might recall that equity was cited as one of the six aims for improvement alongside things we've been focusing on for the last 20 years: timeliness, patient-centeredness, efficacy, safety, and efficiency. And here we are, 20 years later. We haven't had substantial progress in this area. And while there are a lot of reasons for that, equity requires just fundamentally different changes than the improvement in patient satisfaction or process measures. you know, those things can be handled mostly within the four walls of the health system or a provider. But health equity requires us to transform things that are upstream from healthcare that we talk about a lot. But when you really think about what it takes to impact those, it's a very different action and set of people that need to focus on those things and processes and the like. So hence, you know, we've been working the last 20 years and we've achieved some decent quality improvements, but those improvements have been quite inequitable. So the reason for adding equity as a fifth aim is because quality improvement needs to be more equitable. And the ugly truth is that we too easily draft societal issues into healthcare delivery. We are so good at selecting the patients we want to treat. We're obviously pretty good at treating different people different ways because humans do that. You know, one could argue that health equity is already addressed in two of the aims, better experience and better health for populations. But the last 20 years have proven that neither of those two things actually get done in ways that are fair for everyone. So until society can rid itself of racism, we need to call this out as its own strategic priority. And I think our goal should be that this can be embedded just like we embed a lot of other functional things into what care looks like. But coming back to systems thinking, this aim needs to work with the other aims in concert to get where we're going as a system.
Got it. Thanks, Julie. Dave, any comments or questions for Julie?
You know, I'm feeling some of the same ambivalence, Julie, that came through in your response there. If we get the big three aims, you know, outcomes, cost, and customer experience right, the rest should take care of itself, as you said. Explicit focus on caregiver well-being and advancing health equity, if it's not done in a systematic way like you described, could dilute focus on achieving the big three. On the other hand, caregiver burnout and health equity are such big issues that they absolutely require addressing. My hope is that improving caregiver experience and pursuing health equity, like Amedisys has done, become effective means to desired ends. So here's my question for you, particularly given your experience, knowledge, enthusiasm with innovation and health tech. How can these new types of companies and their new types of business models enable the health system to deliver both a better work-life quality for caregivers, fourth aim, and greater health equity, fifth aim?
You know, the two main things I get excited about, especially even as I just talked about, we as humans bring a lot of choice into how we care for people, right? So first, if we have the right data on people, we have the right information on what people might be dealing with, and obviously the right people in healthcare have access to the right information for them, right? We can know more to be able to do more to make sure that the healthcare that's delivered or, gosh, imagine preventative health that's planned is done with someone's social needs in mind and supporting them, providing kind of a better support structure so that they can, in fact, achieve that health. The second thing is the more that we can inform caregivers on how to make good decisions based on research, based on what that patient might present with from, you know, their history, the less variation in care should happen. So, you know, I get excited that this is a place where information technology can really help. And if everyone's practicing at the top of their license, then the choice happens at the right places in our process.
Got it. Health equity at the point of care. I think that's a great goal. All right. Thanks, Julie. Yeah, I would say if the quintuple aim is successful, maybe in the future, that woman wouldn't be turned away by urgent care. All right. Great discussion. Now let's briefly talk about other big stories this past week. Julie, what other healthcare news should we be talking about this week?
Well, I've personally been obsessed with the number of countries and states that are racing to beat each other to pull the mask mandates down. And I'm just really hoping that we as a society can handle the lumps that are going to come our way over the next year. And I'm also excited for people, frankly, to feel like they have a little freedom. I just hope it lasts.
All right. You experienced a taste of that yourself week, right? By meeting somebody in person. That's great. Thank you. Dave, what other healthcare news caught your attention this week and why?
Psychedelic startup MindState's massive $11.5 million angel investment caught my attention. It seems that therapeutic psychedelic compounds may be good for mental health conditions. You know, where's Timothy Leary when you need him? Also, mental health app Headspace is going to advertise during the Super Bowl. Could there be better evidence that mental health is going mainstream?
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. I'll have to find some old record albums too, right? Thanks, Dave, and thank you, Julie. That is all the time we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the topics we discussed on today's show, please visit our website at foresighthealth.com. You also can find a recording of this podcast and all our podcasts on the Healthcare Now Radio Network, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other streaming services. Subscribe now and don't miss another segment of the best 20 minutes in healthcare. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Berta for Foresight Health.